shop the best Black Friday weekend deals up to 70% off only at Tanger Outlets. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Coach, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and hundreds more. Find something for everyone on your list during our biggest sale of the year. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Stores open at 6 a.m. Black Friday. Get your savings at Tanger.com.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm one of your hosts, Katie Halper.
I'm the second host, Aaron Matte. Hi, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us. Our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there to support the show and get bonus content. This week, we're doing something a little different because it's Thanksgiving. We're going to be bringing you two different interviews. We're not going to be bringing you the four basic food groups, but if you want your fill of me and Katie responding to media madness, you can sign up at usefulidiotspodcast.com for the Thursday Throwdown, where we react to the funniest clips of the midweek. In this episode, we are going to bring you an interview with Simon Schuster, who is a reporter for Time Magazine and author of the book, The Showman, Inside the Invasion That Shook the World and Made a Leader of Volodymyr Zelensky. And for this book, Simon Schuster was inside the presidential compound in Ukraine, both before and during the Russian invasion, and has unparalleled insight into how the Ukrainian government, from Zelensky on down, has handled Russia's invasion. And in this interview today, we get into a lot of really important topics.
Yeah, and there's a great debate between Aaron and Simon. But for those Katie Halper fans out there, sit through it to get to me talking again. Don't worry. I don't disappear. No, but the debate is really great. And also, this week's Thursday Throwdown is especially exciting, if I do say so myself, to continue this theme of Katie Halper self-promotion, because we talk about my appearance on Piers Morgan. And we don't talk about my appearance so much as we talk about the people in it, including Jonathan Conricus, the IDF, former IDF spokesman and soldier, and friend of show in some ways that he doesn't know about, the Dersh, Alan Dershowitz.
You know, Katie, we're recording this from, I'm recording this from my parents' house in Vancouver. And when I walked in the door last night, the first thing my parents said to me was, "Did you see Katie on the Piers Morgan show? Because she really showed Alan Dershowitz who's boss." They were, you know, as many people are reacting very positively to your appearance. So
thank
we're
going
to break that down in this week's Thursday Throwdown. So go sign up to usefulidiotspodcast.com to see our breakdown of Katie's appearance with Alan Dershowitz and others on Piers Morgan. So this interview is with Simon Schuster. He is a senior correspondent at Time Magazine, covers international affairs with a focus on Russia and Ukraine. And in his first book, The Showman, Inside the Invasion That Shook the World and Made a Leader of Volodymyr Zelensky, Simon was inside the presidential compound with Zelensky and his aides, reporting on how this invasion from Russia has unfolded from their perspective. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the background to this war and where it could be going, including possibly, as Katie, as you raise, the possibility of nuclear war. So there's a lot of really important discussion in this interview. We hope you enjoy it. Here is Simon Schuster. Simon Schuster, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Great to be with you guys.
You've been covering Ukraine for many years. You wrote a recent book, based on, you know, a lot of reporting inside Ukraine and access to Zelensky's circle. So we're very grateful to have your insight. Just want to start with a broad question. Trump is coming in. There is a lot of speculation about whether he will change the policy, whether he will impose a peace settlement on Ukraine. But on his way out, Joe Biden has given Ukraine this permission to use, for the first time, long-range U.S. weapons to strike into Russia. I'm just curious overall your assessment of where things are inside Ukraine now and where this war is going.
That's a big one to start with. I guess, you know, very broad strokes. I wouldn't be surprised if there was some kind of ceasefire in the first quarter or first half of 2025. That's where things seem to be going. The question on the table and on people's minds in Ukraine and in the president's office in Kyiv is, you know, what the parameters look like of a possible deal with Russia, and what pressure Ukraine can bring to bear to make Putin negotiate in good faith and to give Ukraine some leverage in that. You know, those are kind of the big, broad questions. You know, and all of this is coming at a time when there's substantial exhaustion on both sides militarily. I'd say more on the Ukrainian side, and the Russians are gaining and pushing ahead and gaining territory, especially in the eastern region, in the Donbas. The Ukrainians are at the same time are struggling to hang on to the territory they've taken in Kursk, inside Russian territory. So just kind of broad strokes background, that's sort of where things stand. You know, we can get down into specifics if you like.
Yeah, well, so on the issue of Kursk, so Ukraine launches this surprise incursion into Kursk this summer. Russia has said it won't negotiate so long as Ukrainian troops are in Russian territory. That was seen as, you know, a major attempt by Ukraine to gain leverage in some sort of final negotiation. So where do you see that specific flashpoint going?
Kursk specifically, yeah. I mean, I that was quite clearly one of the main goals, you could say strategic goals of that offensive back in August. To take that territory and use it potentially as a bargaining chip in negotiations with Russia. I think the jury's still out as to whether that was a successful part of the operation. I mean, we don't know. You know, the reaction from Russia has been basically, you know, we're going to take this territory back militarily before we even come to any negotiating table. That seems to be what Russia is signaling. And they are trying to do that at enormous cost to their own army, and now also the military of North Korea is participating in that part of the theater. So I don't know. I mean, I think more directly to your question, I think that will still be a bargaining chip on the table in some fashion, assuming that the Ukrainians can hold on to at least part of that region. They've done it to a surprising degree so far. You know, famously, it's easier to defend than to seize territory. So they're doing that, and they're inflicting, you know, massive casualties on the Russians in the Russian attempt to take that territory back. But the question, you know, the answer to your question fundamentally depends on whether negotiations can begin when Ukraine still holds part of the Kursk region.
Right. And meanwhile, you know, Biden has given Ukraine this permission, this long-sought permission to use ATACMS missiles for strikes deep into Russia. We've already seen at least two separate instances of Ukraine using this new missile system, or this new permission to use the missile system. Russia responded by firing a previously unknown intermediate range missile, which Putin then gave a speech essentially saying that, you know, worse could come unless the West steps back. Do you think that, from your sense, what is Ukraine's hope in terms of what these ATACMS can accomplish, and where do you see that going?
Well, given, you know, how close we seem to be to the beginning of some kind of negotiating process where some real talks begin, everything, you know, is seen through that prism. How much advantage can you gain on the battlefield, and how can you use that as leverage in a negotiation? So all of these long-distance strikes, yes, they do hurt Russia's ability to attack Ukraine. They weaken the Russian forces. They certainly cause some alarm among the Russian population. Hard to measure how much, but, you know, some. But I think the main issue is, you know, in launching these long-range strikes into Russia, Putin doesn't want that to continue. So how much will he trade? What will he give up to stop Ukraine from doing that, continuing to do that in a negotiation? You know, I should note that Ukraine has the capacity to launch pretty substantial long distance strikes, even without the ATACM system, even without foreign weaponry. It has been doing that with homemade drones and missiles for a long time. So the question, again, seen in the context of a possible negotiation that I think we will start seeing soon, is does that give Ukraine leverage? How much is that leverage worth at the negotiating table, this ability to launch these long-range strikes?
You recently tweeted out an article from Pravda in which the former commander of Ukrainian forces, Valery Zaluzhny, says the Third World War has begun. Can you talk about this assessment and why, as you say in your tweet, it's worth taking seriously?
I mean, I think it's been worth taking seriously for a long time. I watch, as part of my coverage of the war, Russian propaganda pretty intently to see, it's a good window into what people in the Kremlin are thinking, honestly, because Russian propaganda channels, they get talking points directly from the presidential administration. And one thing they've been doing quite clearly is talking about, this kind of great war, a civilizational conflict between Russia and the West. They talk all the time about a third world war having already started. So that's sort of one dimension I'd point to. Now the comment from General Zaluzhny was interesting. He's, as you said, the former commander of all of Ukraine's armed forces. He led Ukrainian armed forces in the first about 2 years of the full-scale war. I spent a lot of time with him, in those 2 years, and he's a major figure in the book. And his assessment is based to a large extent on the appearance of North Korean forces on the Russian side in the war. But he also points to the help that Russia has been getting from Iran, China. And he points out the fact that Ukraine is facing a multinational enemy. And in that sense, to his eyes, it looks like World War III is already beginning. Of course, the coalition supporting Ukraine is also very big. We have dozens of countries providing weapons to Ukraine and trying to support Ukraine financially and politically, diplomatically. So I think when he looks at the forces arrayed on both sides, it already looks like the beginning of World War III. I actually had this conversation it's about a year ago now with President Zelensky. One of the interviews I did with him for the book. And we talked about, does this look like World War III to you? And this is quite a while ago, so I'm not going to get the quotes exactly right. But he said something to the effect of, I live with this fear every day. This was around the time that the October 7th, it was just after October 7th, 2023. The war in Gaza and Israel was just beginning. And he said, basically, we live in a time when it seems like any of these flashpoints in the world, on the map of the world, can turn into a global conflagration. And it's something that he lives with and fears every day. This is Zelensky. And General Zaluzhny, looking at the war today, shares those concerns. And I think there are concerns that we all have to take seriously. Again, especially as we look at the way that the Kremlin is preparing its own population for a much larger war than the war in Ukraine.
Speaking of your conversations with Zelensky, I know in your book, he asks you write in your book that he asked you when you plan to finish your book. And you write, "And I told him my aim would be to capture roughly the first year of the war and then publish. His face fell when he heard me say that. You think the war will not be over in a year?" he says. Has his assessment, obviously, I assume it's changed, but do you think he was being naive?
Certainly looks that way now with the benefit of hindsight. So that conversation took place in April, I think, of 2022, about 2 months into the full-scale invasion. And at the time, Ukraine and Russia were directly talking to each other. They were negotiating the terms of a possible peace deal. And Zelensky was still holding on to the hope that fundamentally he could get into a room with Putin and talk this out. This is a very Zelensky thing to do. It's a very Zelensky idea to have, that let me talk to him. Let me talk this out, whether it's Trump, whether it's Putin, whatever. He has a very high regard and a lot of confidence in his own abilities as a communicator and as a negotiator. So at that point, you know, that was sort of front of his mind. He was attempting to, and he, you know, to reach a settlement, and he had very high hopes that he would be able to do that. So I think that's where he was coming from in that statement. So yeah, he didn't think that it would take him, you know, more than a year to end the war. He it was so horrific also to him what he was seeing and what he was experiencing in those days and weeks that it was hard for him to get his head around the fact that it could continue for as long as it has. But you know, now of course, looking back, it's gone on much longer than a year. So yeah, it does look naive.
I guess a related question I have is, do you think that at that point it would have been possible to reach a settlement had certain things gone differently? And of course, there's that famous Boris Johnson visit. I wonder what you think the role of that is in the trajectory of the war.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, generally in my work, I try not to think too much about hypotheticals. So I deal with the reality we have and not possible alternative realities. I also try as much as I can to avoid making big predictions. You know, I think the present and the recent past is interesting enough for me. But that point, you know, I can talk about, you know, why it happened the way it did, the breakdown in those negotiations. It is often pinned on this visit by Boris Johnson. So I was there, you know, kind of spending time with Zelensky's team in those days. I remember the day when Johnson visited, and generally I was talking to the negotiators as they were engaging with the Russians at the time. This is April 2022. I believe Johnson's visit was April 9th. And Johnson's position, as we now, you know, have kind of read about in press reports, wasn't a big factor at the time for the Ukrainians. The biggest factors were, number one, the atrocities that Russian forces had committed in Bucha specifically, a suburb of Kyiv, and other liberated towns around Kyiv. Those had just been exposed. So as the Russians withdrew in early April of 2022 from the suburbs of Kyiv, the world learned and the Ukrainians learned about these atrocities that the Russians had been committing. And that led to a feeling that, you know, among many of Ukraine's negotiators, that we can't talk to these monsters after what they've just done to us. And there were a lot of people inside Zelensky's team who were pushing him to break off the talks with the Russians immediately. And Zelensky, maybe surprisingly, was holding firm in the belief that, no, we need to keep pushing. You need to get me in a room with Putin so I can end this thing. We need to find a way to negotiate our way out of this war. So that was the main point. I think another reason why, you know, eventually... you could say that Zelensky's aides and advisors won out in that particular argument, because eventually Zelensky did say, yes, we can't talk to these monsters. Another reason he did that, and important to note, and I do think, you know, on the balance, it's more important or significant than Boris Johnson's position, is the overall feeling of strength that Zelensky had in those weeks. We're talking, again, the spring of 2022, Ukraine achieved victory in the Battle of Kyiv. It had averted the worst case scenario of the invasion. So the capital stood. That gave Zelensky quite a strong sense of, well, he can survive this thing. And then there were a series of smaller victories that Ukraine achieved at the time. One that comes to mind is the sinking of the flagship of the Russian Black Sea Fleet, the Moskva. You know, now, with hindsight, it seems like a fairly insignificant thing. But at the time, this was a huge morale boost. And there were a series of these events, I won't go into all of them, but that gave Zelensky a feeling of, hey, maybe we don't need to negotiate. Maybe we can win this thing on the battlefield. And that sense of high morale and confidence, I think, was a bigger factor in leading Zelensky to sort of push the negotiations to the side than the position of Boris Johnson. Just one more point on the Johnson thing. You know, he was expressing, as far as I know now, I haven't interviewed Johnson. I'd like to, but I sort of haven't gotten a chance. He was expressing an idea that was pretty widespread among Ukraine's Western allies at the time, is these negotiations that Ukraine and Russia were having in the spring of 2022, Ukraine was trying to get Western allies to basically guarantee the results of whatever those negotiations would be. So to provide security guarantees such that if Russia violates those agreements, the Western allies or Ukraine's foreign allies would sort of step in to protect Ukraine. And the Western allies were essentially saying, you know, we're not ready to do that. You guys can negotiate, but we're not, you know, going to guarantee whatever you come up with. You know, we're not, you know, they didn't really want to be party to those negotiations, honestly. So that's my understanding and my sense of where Boris Johnson was coming from, and he wasn't alone. He maybe expressed that to Zelensky in sort of his typically bombastic way, but I think that Zelensky was hearing the same thing from a number of Western allies.
If I put the available evidence together, I come to a different conclusion. And let me just lay out some of it. I'm curious your response. So on the issue of the security guarantees, what I don't understand about the Western position there is that, you know, the West promised Ukraine eventual membership into NATO anyway, which the whole thing about NATO membership is you're providing a security guarantee under Article 5. So it's not as if the West was unwilling to provide a security guarantee. It seems to me that they were unwilling to provide one if it could end the war quickly, which would then undermine the U.S.'s stated goal of essentially handing Russia a strategic defeat in Ukraine, or in the words of Lloyd Austin, to weaken Russia. So I never understood how the West could promise Ukraine a security guarantee one day in the future under NATO and then, you know, risk a war over it, because that was Russia's key demand before invading, that they commit to neutrality for Ukraine, but then deny Ukraine security guarantees when that provision could help end the war because it would underpin the peace deal with Russia. Johnson was quoted as saying by Ukrainian sources who first disclosed this meeting that they saw an opportunity here to smash Putin because Putin was weak, which plays into the idea that the West was using Ukraine to weaken Russia. And then you have Ukrainian negotiators, the chief negotiator, who's a member of Zelensky's party. You can, David
Abahavi.
Yeah. He said that Russia's key demand was neutrality for Ukraine. He didn't mention the alleged Russian atrocities in Bucha. And as you mentioned, Zelensky said that the atrocities in Bucha underscore all the more reason for us to make peace so we can stop more atrocities from happening. Another Ukrainian negotiator, Chali, he said that, you know, Russia did everything possible to make peace and that they were very close. And we recently got from the New York Times these very, very detailed draft documents that were worked on by both sides. Well, you know, there were still some differences, obviously, but, those documents to me show how far both sides went in brokering a deal. So then all of a sudden, when you have Johnson coming in saying, we're not going to back you up with the security guarantees you need, and we think you should keep fighting because Putin is weak. And recently you had Victoria Nuland in another admission saying that, you know, this would have, if Ukraine had agreed to this, they would have essentially been neutered because we wouldn't have been able to place offensive missiles inside Ukraine. That to me, you know, bolsters the argument that Ukraine's allies here were concerned that they were losing their right to use Ukraine for their ultimate goal of bleeding Russia.
Wow. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, Aaron. I'm not sure where to start. I mean, one thing that jumps out at me is, you know, you seem to be in laying out your points, ignoring the factor of Ukrainian agency and what Ukrainians wanted to do at the time and what their president and their leadership wanted to do at the time. So, you know, in what you say, it sounds like Ukraine is a mere instrument of Western machinations. That's not really what it looked like to me on the ground. It looked like certainly in those months and to a large extent ever since, the Ukrainians were very much steering events through the force of their defense and through the force of their diplomacy as personified by President Zelensky. So I think you shouldn't discount the role that Ukraine had in actually pushing the Western powers to take this or that course of action, because Ukraine basically left them no choice. Ukraine was going to defend themselves. Whether the West was going to leave Ukraine on the Ukrainians on their own to do that, well, that was a choice that the West could have made, but they would, the West, the United States included, would have looked very weak and reckless, honestly, by allowing a genocidal aggressor to swallow up its neighbor like that, its democratic neighbor. So, you know, that's sort of another way you could see it. And to me, honestly, I think, you know, the main point I would make in response to what you said is don't underestimate the role that Ukraine played in deciding its fate and deciding how this has all played out.
Okay, but it's not just me who thinks that there was a Western interest in using Ukraine to bleed Russia. Let me quote to you Zelensky. He gave an interview to The Economist in late March 2022, just as these talks with Russia were proceeding. And he said this: "There are those in the West who don't mind a long war because it would mean exhausting Russia, even if this means the demise of Ukraine and comes at the cost of Ukrainian lives. This is definitely in the interests of some countries." So that was Zelensky also acknowledging that there are some countries who do see Ukraine as an instrument. And it's my argument that that's who ultimately won out here, because after Zelensky says this in late March, they do hammer out a pretty detailed agreement with Russia. Russia wouldn't be swallowing up Ukraine. The status of Crimea, as I understand the agreement that was brokered in Istanbul, the status of Crimea and the Donbas would have been left to future talks directly between Putin and Zelensky. The rest of Ukraine would have remained under Ukrainian sovereignty for sure, and Ukraine would have been free to join the European Union, which Russia has been accused of trying to block. So, and that's why you had Ukrainian officials saying, it wasn't me saying this, that Putin didn't make a compromise. So I'm not alone in saying that there was a Western interest.
Yeah,
and there are also many U.S. officials who said this is a great investment for us because they're killing Russians on our behalf.
Right. Yeah. I remember Lindsey Graham put this in very kind of stark and quite shocking terms. I think Mitch McConnell said something to that effect. No, I mean, I'm not discounting what your point. I think there were definitely a lot of officials and military leaders in the West, in the United States included, who saw a strategic opportunity to weaken a strategic adversary without involving their own troops. That's right. The thing is that the Ukrainians wanted to defend themselves, and they wanted to defeat Russia, to push Russia back and to get their territory back. So that doesn't, that, you know, that makes them allies. It doesn't make Ukraine an instrument of some kind of Western conspiracy.
It does. But if there's a reasonable opportunity to prevent further bloodshed and further loss of territory, which is what I think they had in the spring with the Istanbul talks, why not pursue that as opposed to, you know, listening to Boris Johnson and Victoria Nuland, who are saying, don't do this because, you know, you'll be neutered militarily, when the result is you lose, you know, a lot of people and a lot more territory. And if the West had offered, let me ask you this, if the West had offered Ukraine the security guarantees that Ukraine was asking for to make a peace deal with Russia, do you think that Zelensky would have still walked away?
Hard to say. Yeah, that's another one of these hypotheticals. And, you know, one thing that I learned, I mean, generally in my work, but also while working on this book, is that, well, a couple things. First, you really got to be humble about using the benefit of hindsight, because in the moment, especially if, you know, you were there seeing these arguments play out in real time back then, you have to judge it based on the information that the decision makers had available to them at that time, what emotions were driving them, what strategic prerogatives were driving them. You know, it's not very helpful to look back from our perspective now to some, you know, 2+ years into the future and say you made a mistake. I mean, yeah, that may seem obvious now, but can we judge the decision makers at the time for deciding to take the actions that they did? I mean, that's tough. I try not to do that just because, that, you know, that's not fair, the hindsight point. I mean, also, the second point I'd make is, and also it's kind of a point about humility when you really dig down into the cause and effect of this or that turning point in the war, or really any kind of turning point in history, is there's usually not one factor. It's usually a very complicated muddle of factors that lead to these turning points in history. So those negotiations, the now called kind of the Istanbul talks or whatever in the spring of 2022, definitely a turning point. But if you look seriously, as I tried to do in researching the book, at what was really going on the ground, what was going on in the minds of the decision makers, it is complicated. There are a lot of factors at play. So the suggestion that, you know, for example, as some people make kind of in a hand-waving fashion, that Boris Johnson came and jettisoned these talks is just intellectually lazy, because there were many different factors. I've pointed to some of them: Bucha, Zelensky's sense that he could achieve victory on the battlefield and therefore didn't need to focus so much on negotiations. Another factor was domestic Ukrainian politics. You know, would Zelensky survive politically if he were to sign some kind of armistice with the Russians after the atrocities that the Russians had just committed? You know, these are all kind of push and pull factors that an honest look at this question needs to take into account. So I'm really against kind of picking out one particular factor and saying, you know, this is the person, you know, Nuland or whatever, Boris Johnson did it. These were pretty minor voices in the heads of the decision makers on the ground in Kyiv who were making the decisions about how to negotiate, when to cut off negotiations, and so on. You know, I know that because I was there talking to them at the time, including David Arahamia, who you cited, you know, in reference to Boris Johnson.
I guess we'll disagree here on the, you know, scale of the influence of the U.S. and U.K. because, you know, to me, given that Ukraine relies, I mean, this is not contested. Ukraine relies on the U.S. for so much. You know, we recently learned from the New York Times that in the aftermath of 2014, the overthrow of Yanukovych, the CIA built up bases. U.S. became very influential inside Ukraine. And then militarily, of course, Ukraine was reliant on these tens of billions of dollars in military support. So in that kind of situation, for me, when I see, you know, Victoria Nuland and Boris Johnson expressing their opposition to the peace deal that Ukraine negotiated with Russia and saying, we're not going to give you the security guarantees you need to secure that deal, to me, that strikes me as instrumental. But I understand you were on the ground, you were with Zelensky's team, and you had insight into their decision making that the rest of us don't. I'm going to ask you one more hindsight question, though, if you'll indulge me, which is the Minsk Accords. Prior to Russia's invasion, you had this agreement that was reached in 2015, in which basically the conflict in the Donbas that broke out in 2014 would end if Ukraine granted some autonomy to the ethnic Russians regions of the Donbas that had rebelled after the overthrow of Yanukovych. And Zelensky was elected with a lot of hope inside of Ukraine, with a mandate to make peace, to end the war. There were many people who saw him as a legitimate outsider who was promising to make peace, who was going to, you know, break with the years of corruption and warfare that Ukraine was mired in. My impression from your book, though, is that Zelensky essentially gave up on trying to implement the Minsk Accords because he saw the people of the Donbas as Russian dupes. Let me quote you what you write. When Zelensky took office, he promised to let these people in the Donbas vote, believing he could win their support. But he soon realized he could not reach them. They had been brainwashed, he said, by years of Russian propaganda. Instead of holding elections in the Donbas, Zelensky tried to go after the source of Russian propaganda in Ukraine, the television channels that Viktor Medvedchuk, who's an ally of Putin, used to spread the Kremlin's message. Without its TV channels, the party did not stand a chance in the political arena. And that's when Zelensky, shortly after Biden takes office, shuts down these Russia-aligned TV channels inside Ukraine and, you know, brings charges against a close Putin ally, Medvedchuk. And you also quote Zelensky as saying this: the people of the Donbas have been brainwashed. They live in the Russian information space. I can't reach them. There is no hope of making those people understand that Russia is really an occupying power. Well, my question is, you know, and again, you're not speaking on behalf of Zelensky, but I'm curious why Zelensky didn't consider just implementing the Minsk Accords, let these people vote the way they want to, and, you know, like respect their will, rather than, you know, continuing the years of warfare against the Donbas and ultimately helping lead to this situation where Russia comes in to resolve that conflict with an invasion.
Yeah, fair question. And Aaron, as you know, and Katie, as I'm sure you've seen, there's been endless discussion about this in diplomatic circles and in the press and among analysts. You know, I spend at least a chapter of the book talking about this issue and sort of laying out how it went wrong. To the most direct answer I can give to your question is that Russia did not, or I could say also did not abide by the Minsk agreements. The fundamental disagreement between the two sides, Russia and Ukraine, was who should take which conciliatory step first. So Zelensky came into office in 2019 saying he wants to, make peace in the Donbas, reach a peace deal with Russia. And one of the things that he was really pushing hard to do as a you could say, concession to the Russians, or something that's definitely written into the Minsk agreements, is let the Donbas vote. Let the people who live in the Russian-occupied regions of eastern Ukraine choose legitimate leaders that the world can recognize, and that those leaders should then speak on behalf of the people who live in these territories.
As the cold weather hits, we all feel that looming pressure to buy a whole new wardrobe as temperatures and fashion trends change. Here's the problem. So many of those fast fashion companies churn out low-quality clothes that will be tattered and out of style by next year, creating an endless cycle of buying, buying, and buying. But we found a solution, timeless American-made clothes that never go out of style, and we're getting them from American Giant. You'll never need to restock again. American Giant obsesses over every detail of their clothes, so you know you're getting the best. We're wearing American Giant. You should, too. This season, snag the hoodie that will bring you comfort for life, the American Giant Classic Full Zip. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Save 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code USEFUL.
Shop the best Black Friday weekend deals up to 70% off only at Tanger Outlets. Save big at Crocs, Old Navy Outlet, American Eagle Outfitters, Kay Jewelers, and hundreds more. Find something for everyone on your list during our biggest sale of the year. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Stores open at 6 a.m. Black Friday. Get your savings at Tanger.com. Big time deals on big name brands.
That's something he tried very hard for a long time to do. But one of the things that he refused to budge on is we can't hold elections in the Donbas as long as there are Russian troops occupying that region and basically controlling events there, controlling the border, controlling the police, controlling the way that this vote would be held. So he, and I think most Ukrainians, did not have a lot of faith in the honesty of the Russian military in facilitating or allowing a free and fair election to take place in the Donbas. So Zelensky was pushing on another point in the Minsk Accords. First, before we hold these elections, Russia, get your troops out of there, and then we'll have the elections. So you move first, and then we'll have the elections. Russia refused to do that. As I write in the book, one of the reasons Putin refused to do that is that he continued to lie to the world and to his own people and to the Ukrainians that, oh, these are not Russian troops. These are not Russian weapons. You know, these are all sort of self-defense rebels that we don't have any control over. You know, an obvious bold-faced lie. But Putin stuck to this, and his negotiators stuck to it at the negotiating table. And you can see how this leads to a dead end. If one side refuses to even acknowledge that, yes, it is in military control of these regions, it's hard to move past that. So, you know, there's a lot more we could say in terms of the nuances, the negotiations, and why they broke down. But that's basically how it happened. You know, the fundamental point that they couldn't come to an agreement on. You know, get your troops out first, then we'll have the elections. Russia says no, have the elections, and then we'll talk about maybe getting our troops out.
My impression was that Putin did lie at first, obviously lied at first about, you know, claiming that it was just that everyone in Ukraine, which is Ukrainians, there were no Russians, you know, he did lie first, but I guess you can correct me if I'm wrong. I thought he eventually did acknowledge that there was a Russian military intervention inside
in Crimea. Especially
in Crimea, no, but also in the Donbas in August 2014, when, you know, Russia, you know, forcefully intervened by sending troops in. I thought it after that point, I don't think he lied about it. Correct me if I'm wrong. But as I understand the Minsk Accords, and I know there's all, it's a very contested issue, everyone has a different interpretation. Yeah. What the key thing that happened that had to happen first was that there be a dialogue between Kyiv and the you know, rebel leaders on a special status and on holding elections. Mm-hmm. And whenever Ukraine tried to do that, like, for example, in August 2015, when they tried to advance a measure in the parliament, you know, advancing a special status for the Donbas, there were riots led by the far right with people, you know, and even one of them was deadly with a police officer or a few police officers killed. And after that point, the Ukrainian first Poroshenko and then Zelensky abandoned that effort to push through a law. And that, to me, as I understand the sequence of Minsk, that was the key first step. Special status for the Donbas first, followed by a dialogue between Kyiv and the Donbas leaders. And then finally, at the end, you have Ukraine receiving the full control of its borders again. Because from the Russian Donbas point of view, if they didn't have the special status in the elections first, then they risk just being, you know, being wiped out, as some Ukrainian officials wanted to do. They wanted to retake that full region by force.
Yeah, I mean, we're getting pretty deep into the historical weeds here, but I think, you know, you're right that there was definitely this very crucial clause there in the Minsk agreements about special status for the Donbas. That requires or would require Ukraine to change its constitution. So sometimes it's referred to as sort of constitutional reforms that were required under the Minsk agreements. You know, philosophically, the disagreement there was, or the problem was, and the Russians talked about this openly. I quote a number of the architects on the Russian side of the Minsk agreements saying that this constitutional reform would basically give us political leverage over Ukraine's future. Over its future to decide whether it's going to join NATO, whether it's going to join the European Union, because what it would essentially create inside the Ukrainian body politic is a region that is that can be that would be loyal to Russia for economic reasons, for political reasons, for reasons of corruption, you know, deep kind of economic ties and political ties. It would be as one high-level Russian official told me, the Russian soloist in the great Ukrainian choir, and that soloist would sing for us, meaning sing for Russia. So that's a problem. You know, many Ukrainians saw it as a problem to create this sort of pro-Russian bastion in the country, constitutionally kind of lock that in, because it would risk, at the very least, risk blocking Ukraine's ability to decide its Western course, its course toward Western integration. Russia wanted to stop Ukraine from taking that course, and it was pursuing that goal of stopping that kind of Western integration by these political or pseudo-political means, mixed with military means as well, certainly in the Donbas. And Ukraine was trying to stop them. So basically, what you hear a lot from the Ukrainian decision makers who were there on the ground, including President Poroshenko, and later on Zelensky came around to the same view, is that the Minsk agreements were a poison pill for Ukraine's NATO ambitions and for its EU ambitions. Because if Ukraine went ahead with these constitutional reforms that would grant a great deal of autonomy to the Donbas, they would essentially create this deadlock within Ukrainian politics that would never allow Ukraine to take the steps necessary for Western integration.
Very quickly, Simon, but that is because you do have millions of people in the Donbas who do not want to be a part of NATO. And so this poison pill towards NATO, yes, it would be that. But it also, I think, would be reflecting sort of a consensus view in a very divided country, people who want to join NATO and not join NATO. And
Very good point. And this is something I discussed at length. You know, you quoted a part of that in the book. I discussed this at length with Zelensky. And honestly, I was amazed by how that question of winning over the people who live in the occupied territories, the millions of people who live in Crimea, who live in the occupied parts of the Donbas, you know, we talk a lot about the military dimension of doing that, right? How many tanks, how many fighters, how many missiles do you need to reconquer those territories from the Russians? That's one dimension that Zelensky thinks about. as a politician and as a communicator, he also thinks about, what am I going to say to those people? Many of them, millions of them, have been living under Russian occupation for 10 years, getting their information from Russian propaganda channels. You know, if you think about it, 10 years, right? So that means that when the Russian occupation started, the youngest soldiers who are now fighting with Russia on the side of the Russian forces from the Donbas were 10 years old. So yes, Zelensky looked at that and saw it as a really almost insurmountable political problem or problem of communications. How do you convince those people that Ukraine is their home? And he thought about ways to do that. In our conversations, he didn't offer much of a roadmap that I found convincing. But he said, one thing we damn sure need to do is turn off the Russian propaganda channels and basically plug in our own. So give those people access to Ukrainian TV so that Zelensky can quite literally speak to them. Would that work? I don't know. That's a hypothetical that we haven't tested yet at all. But that's the way that he was thinking about it. So, you know, it's a very difficult challenge after 10 years of them living, and as he put it, and as he quoted, in the Russian information space, to win them back, to make them feel like Ukraine is their home and Kyiv is their capital. That's a very hard challenge. And he has been thinking about ways to do that, but I don't think he has a clear picture other than this kind of, you know, turning off the Russian channels, turning on the Ukrainian ones.
Well, and that to me sounds, if you're shutting off channels, then you're not respecting democracy, because that's what dictators do. Is, you know, Putin shuts down opposition TV channels that he doesn't like. And one alternative would be to let people speak the Russian language, their efforts to curb use of the Russian language, and to respect their cultural rights and to recognize that, you know, Ukrainians of the East are just as Ukrainian as the Ukrainian, as Ukrainians in Western regions. And that's why, to me, and we can move on now, because I've sparred with you enough on this, but it's you're right. It is a lot of hypotheticals now, and it's a lot of hindsight. But to me, if Zelensky had fulfilled his mandate to, you know, he talked about how people in the East should be able to speak Russian. You know, he said a lot of those things. And I personally, I wish he had followed through on that rather than listening to groups like the Azov Battalion and Right Sector and Svoboda, who did not see these people in the East as equal Ukrainians.
I think that's not fair at all. So I have spent a lot of time, you know, in Ukraine, including in the Russian-speaking parts of Ukraine. My family, I have a lot of relatives in Odessa, which is a Russian-speaking city historically and culturally. There was never a threat to, so no one was trying to stop them from speaking Russian. This is, and you know, Aaron, I'm sorry, you know, you're often accused online of sort of parroting Russian talking points, but this idea that the Russian language was somehow under significant existential threat, that does come from, that is a Russian invention.
But was it not one of the first measures that the new Ukrainian parliament tried to pass after overthrowing Yanukovych, is curbing the use of the Russian language, essentially banning it as an official second language?
But you got to think about what that means. So they insisted on Ukrainian being the language of the state, and that is the only language you speak to when you deal. You speak when you say in the court of law or on television channels. So TV should be in Ukrainian because that is the national language. These kinds of things. But you know, it's not right to say that some of Russians were being persecuted for speaking Russian. Now, if you go and spend time with the forces who are fighting on the front lines against Russia and spilling their blood and sacrificing their lives, you spend time with them, they're talking on their radios in Russian. They're talking to each other in Russian. They're Russian speaking Ukrainians. So, you know, and they're fighting and dying for Ukraine. So, you know, I really have to push back and want to be really careful about this idea that somehow the Russian language was under threat of persecution in Ukraine. I never saw that. My family never experienced it. And this is really something that the Russian side has pushed in its propaganda, that the language was somehow under threat.
But how about the cultural identity? Because if you have, you know, as we talked about, Medvedchuk, who's who at the time when he was, you know, charged by Zelensky, he's the top opposition leader in the country. Some polls even show that his party was ahead of Zelensky. So when he's being persecuted and his Russian affiliated TV channels are being shut down, can you understand why people in the East see that as an affront, not necessarily on their language, but on their culture.
Well, and on their political representation,
yeah.
You could say. Yeah. So, I mean, this is a point that I go pretty deep on in the book. You know, I devote a chapter to Medvedchuk, this close friend of Vladimir Putin, who was acting basically as Putin's agent for many years inside Ukrainian politics. I interviewed him. I describe his history, his relationship with Putin. And in my book and in my views, Zelensky deserves a lot of criticism for the way he cracked down on Medvedchuk. He was criticized by the EU government. He was criticized by a lot of human rights groups and freedom of speech activists. And crucially, by members of Zelensky's own governing coalition. Told Zelensky, you can't do that. You can't go blocking these guys' TV channels. You can't go seizing their assets. That's outside of the Constitution. That's illegal, as one of his close advisors told Zelensky at the time. You can't do that to these guys. Yes, they're bastards. Yes, they are Russian agents. But they are quite sneakily using the law and using Ukraine's kind of political freedoms to undermine Ukrainian sovereignty and national identity from within. But we have to respect the laws of Ukraine in fighting back against them. And Zelensky took a different course. He did not listen to the criticisms coming from his own advisors or from some of his Western allies, the Europeans. And he went after these guys. And again, I spent a lot of time talking to Zelensky about this, why he did this. And his views were pretty consistent. They hardened over time. At first, he was a little bit, when this was happening in the moment, he was quite, I would say, self-conscious about this decision. He wasn't sure that it was the right thing to do, that he cracked down so hard on these pro-Russian forces. But over time, and especially with the beginning of the full-scale invasion in 2022, he came to believe that he was absolutely right. And I also, in my reporting, came to understand more clearly why he cracked down so hard on them. He saw them as basically an element of the Russian invasion that began before the tanks rolled in. He saw those Russian TV channels as an information war that was almost as dangerous as the Russian missiles that would soon start to fly at Ukrainian cities. So that's why he shut them down. But, is it unconstitutional? Arguably, yes. And he faced those criticisms at the time, and he made those decisions anyway. What would have happened if he had not cracked down on those channels? If you read the book, I think there's an argument to be made that maybe Putin would not have invaded. But we don't know. Hypothetical.
And there's one more factor that we haven't mentioned here, and this speaks to, my own personal criticism of the role of the U.S. here, which is that in your reporting, you spoke to a key Ukrainian aide, Oleksandr Danliuk, who was Zelensky's first national security advisor. And he told you, and I found this extremely revealing, he told you that Zelensky shutting down these Russian-aligned TV networks was, quote, conceived as a welcome gift to the Biden administration. And that going after these stations, quote, was calculated to fit in with the U.S. agenda. And that, mm-hmm. to me, again, going back to what we said before, this is an example of the U.S. not respecting the very real divisions inside Ukrainian society and encouraging steps that would undermine the Minsk Accords and encourage confrontation.
I'd say that's a fair point of view. I didn't only hear that from Danyluk, but also from officials in the State Department that I interviewed about this. They were cheering for Zelensky's crackdown against Medvedchuk and against Medvedchuk's pro-Russian TV channels. And this happened about a month after President Biden was inaugurated. So, yes, that is why Danyluk, said to me this lined up with Biden coming to power. It's kind of a long, complicated story. And I would encourage people to kind of look deeply into the reporting from that period. But yes, the position of the United States was notably different to the position of the Europeans when it came to this question. Should Zelensky crack down on these channels or not? How hard should he hit these pro-Russian forces inside Ukraine who were fighting the information war against Ukraine. The Europeans were more cautious and saying, you know, we need to stick to the letter of the law, and we can't, you know, use kind of extra constitutional methods to wage this information war against the Russians in Ukraine. Whereas the Americans under the Biden administration in the State Department in that period were saying, no, you know, full steam ahead. You know, these are malign Russian influence actors. They are trying to destroy Ukraine from within, and Zelensky is fully within his rights to crack down on them. This was a disagreement at the time, and it remains, you know, I think a contentious point in studying the history of how we got here. So I take your point, and I think you it's a fair one.
Okay, so I'm going to shift gears a little bit, although this was a fascinating debate. What is your prediction in terms of the likelihood of World War III? I know you don't like predictions. Then I'll ask you another normal question. But
No, I'll take it. I'd go back to, you know, I'm just freaked out by the way that what Russians, in, you know, including some of my family members who live in Russia, my grandmother is there, other family members, you know, the information they're getting from Russian TV. I watch it. It's available on YouTube. There are good services that provide English translations. The way that they talk about the use of nuclear weapons, the way that they, in such a flippant way, the way that they talk about World War III, the way that they talk about the need for Russian mothers to sacrifice their sons in this great geopolitical standoff against the West. I mean, it is just mad. It's maddening and it's terrifying. You know, you have to take that stuff with a grain of salt. Because this is, you know, whatever political reasons, this jingoism that you often hear in authoritarian societies regimes that are trying to sort of stir up nationalist fervor and so on. But, you know, when you kind of open that Pandora's box, it's hard to go back and say, actually, no, we're going to, you know, we're not going to do a World War III. We're going to go back to, you know, trading oil and gas with the West, and everything's going to be fine. It would be hard for a future regime, whether under Putin or some future leader of Russia, to put that genie back in that bottle. And that's what, you know, the first thing that comes to mind when, you know, in response to your question about World War III, listen to what the Russians are saying about World War III and how they're sort of spoon feeding these ideas to their own population.
So then what do you think the response of the West should be to that if we want to avoid World War III?
As a journalist, I really try to avoid, you know, telling the decision makers what to do.
Well, you don't have to say, okay, I can rephrase it.
My opinion.
Not necessarily as an advisor, but more as a thinker and journalist, what do you think if the West wanted to, or wants to avoid World War III, what do you think would be wise for them to do?
I mean, I agree with the general kind of consensus view that Russia needs to lose this war and be defeated in Ukraine in order for it not to continue with its kind of broader ideological program of defeating the West, defeating NATO. So you need to fight back as hard and as fast as you can and kind of nip the thing in the bud. I hate that cliche, but forgive me, while you can in Ukraine. And I think that was driving a lot of the strategic thinking that we talked about a little earlier in the conversation about, you know, as Aaron, as you put it, using the Ukrainians to weaken Russia. So Lloyd Austin, the current Secretary of Defense, said that in 2022, that we need to weaken this strategic opponent before they're allowed to go any further. You know, strategically speaking, if you want to avoid, if you want to stop a reactionary authoritarian regime that has repeatedly said it is waging a civilizational war against the West, you need to stop them somehow. So Russia is already on this war footing. Its economy is already on this war footing. And I think it is in the best interests of the West to stop that before it goes any further. So, I mean, that's not a kind of that's a pretty mainstream position. You know, that's what you hear from the decision makers generally. I understand, you know, you don't agree with that. You see the risk of a nuclear exchange or some kind of World War III is too high. But I agree with you know, the other side of that argument, that if you sort of give Russia a win in Ukraine, you will pay a much higher price down the road.
So you're saying, and this is not a rhetorical question, you're saying that some kind of nuclear war is preferable to letting, like, Russia win for the sake of democracy?
So I don't think, that is a big question. So yeah. The current threats, the most recent threats of nuclear escalation that Putin has made, seem implausible to me because Russia is winning. I think I was very concerned about Russia using nuclear weapons in Ukraine when Russia was losing in 2022. It was also making the same threats. It's been making those threats for a long time. But basically, Russia would be at highest risk of making, of actually going there, if it was at risk of losing. You know, that's a risk that the world has to manage. I've talked to Zelensky about this. And, you know, basically his position is like, they're already hitting us with everything they have. If they use a tactical nuclear weapon in Ukraine, we'll keep fighting. And at that point, I think the West, if Russia goes there, would have to increase support to really put that genie back in that bottle by force before Russia does it again and continues to do it, right? So, I mean, that would make sense to me. Sorry to ramble, but I don't think the choice that you presented is exactly, we're not choosing between peace and nuclear use. We're choosing between ways to contain a very aggressive authoritarian regime that has set out to basically humble and destroy the West.
There's a contradiction, right, or a tension, because you're saying that you fear that, or you think that Russia is more likely to use nuclear weapons if they're losing, but you also think that Russia should be defeated. So yep. What would happen in that scenario?
That's right. There is that tension. And that's sort of boiling it down, the really crucial and difficult challenge that the brains up in the State Department or the Pentagon are having to wrestle with. Right. And it's been interesting to observe how they've done that and how different decision makers have reacted in different points in the full scale war when we were coming up to. I mean, this is now long in the past. But in 2022, there were moments when Russia was losing so badly, especially in the fall of 2022, that you know, there were really a lot of legitimate concerns and kind of gaming out. OK, if Russia does this, what do we do in response and so on? We didn't get there yet. I think it's still very much a risk. But I generally land, just to repeat myself, on the view that, you know, if you allow Russia to swallow up Ukraine and get its way in Ukraine to neuter it militarily and so on, it won't satisfy the appetites of the beast that Putin has unleashed with Russian militarism and expansionism.
I totally hear what you're saying. And interestingly, there's a Gallup poll that just came out showing that 52% of Ukrainians would like to see their country negotiate an end to the war as soon as possible. And that's understandably 52%. It's understandably up from 22% in 2022. How do you balance those desires with a continued war with Russia?
I mean, I think President Zelensky and his allies are very much balancing those desires and taking those into account. If you look at the evolution in Zelensky's statements recently, I mean, I'm talking in the past year or so, he very much tracks the views of public opinion. So now what you hear Zelensky talking about more and more is not "we will fight and get it all back." Meaning all of the occupied territories. He talks about the need for security guarantees. He takes a much softer line when compared to, a year ago or even a few months ago. I think a couple of days ago, his chief of staff, Andriy Yermak, you know, took an even softer line in an interview with a Swedish publication about where the requirements would be for a negotiated peace. So I think we see in the rhetoric of Zelensky and his team and his negotiators, a reflection of that changing public opinion, the level of exhaustion among Ukrainians with this war, the public desire for peace, and also honestly factoring in the growing desire in Western capitals for some kind of negotiated ceasefire. So we're hearing all that from Zelensky. Zelensky has not been sort of dogmatic or stuck in one point of view on this. His views have evolved along with public opinion.
Simon, we're going to wrap, and we really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much.
The points I want to make just very quickly, and then we'll give you the last word, which is, you know, for me, given that you have previous instances where, you know, Russia and Ukraine have agreed on certain points, Ukraine's declaration of state sovereignty called for the establishment of a permanent neutral state. That's what Yanukovych called for and tried to implement before he was overthrown. Then you had the Minsk Accords, which as much as some Ukrainians in Zelensky's circle have problems with, you know, that was agreed to by Ukraine, which called for recognizing the autonomy of the Donbas within Ukraine. And you had the Istanbul Accords, which were very detailed agreements reached out, brokered between the two sides. Ukrainian officials, some of them, acknowledge this. That to me shows that there's a basis for a settlement. And it would require, though, Ukraine giving up on this, you know, quest to join NATO, which polls have historically shown Ukraine's very divided on, especially if you include the regions of the Donbas that have been excluded since 2014. So that to me is a better alternative to continued warfare against a Russian army that is far stronger, because just Russia's right there and it's a massive country. And previously that was considered conventional wisdom, but that's sort of been lost now in this war fever since Russia's invasion especially. So those are the points that I wanted to make. We'll leave you with the last word, and we're very grateful again to you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I mean, you know, it's your show. I don't want to take the last word from you. Yeah, I guess if you let me make one final remark. Yeah, I think we have to listen to what the Ukrainians want and their perspective. You know, having spent so much time in the country, I understand their deep, deep desire to live in peace. And it seems like with a neighbor such as Russia, you need security guarantees that Russia will not invade again. And the only security guarantees that we see on the horizon is NATO membership, basically living under the NATO umbrella. That provides something like a solid security guarantee in the 21st century. And I can understand why Ukrainians simply don't see any other option but going there. Otherwise, they will be swallowed up one way or another by this genocidal aggressor that they have to their east. So I don't think it's fair to the Ukrainians to say, you know, no, the only security guarantees available aren't available to you. Live with it. That seems unfair to me. That's just the last point I would make.
You've been talking about how, you know, Ukraine is not a kind of mere instrument or pawn, and it has its own agency and desires. I'm just curious if you think, though, that the West's motives are about democracy or about something else. In other words, are they more self-interested than they are about protecting Ukrainian lives and saving Ukrainian lives, which of course doesn't mean that Ukraine is not does not have agency. I'm just curious how you see the relationship between the West and Ukraine. Does that make sense, that question?
Yeah, I think it you know, as I was saying before, when you really dig down into questions like that, it's there are a lot of factors. There are factors like, you know, the role of the individual in history and how someone like President Biden wants to be remembered in the context of this war as what, you know, that's one important factor. There's a factor of strategic decision makers like, for example, Lloyd Austin or General Mark Milley, thinking about the geostrategic map and where are the threats coming from and how do we neutralize those threats with the least cost to the United States. And then there are other factors like the outpouring of compassion and sympathy that the American people and many people around the world showed to Ukraine in those early days of the full-scale invasion and wanting to help them defend themselves. That was also a major driver of how Western support and Western attitudes toward Ukraine were shaped and continue to be shaped by those kinds of factors and changes in public opinion, the public mood toward Ukraine. So I can't point to one thing that sort of shapes or defines Western interests in Ukraine. As you often find when you deal with these really complicated questions, it's complicated.
And would you say that the Lindsey Graham discourse that you mentioned earlier, where he's very craven and talks about how this is about money and minerals, is that, do you think, kind of a fringe position in the United States government?
I think it's you know, he's playing to a certain particular audience. In some ways, it's an audience of one, Donald Trump. There have been a number of advisors, including Mike Pompeo, who I met with in Kyiv in September when he was visiting with Zelensky there. And he was advising Zelensky, look, if you want to get in good with the Trump administration or Donald Trump personally, you need to think of him as a businessman and offer him these kinds of incentives that play to his ideas as a businessman. You know, that's one way to do it. I don't know. And Zelensky seems in some of his actions and statements to be taking that advice on board. It's hard for me to judge how much that represents broadly some kind of consensus view or desire in Washington. I think that kind of approach, you know, as you called it, craven or whatever, greed-based or business-minded, however you want to call it, is kind of a specific group of people who are now, you know, going to be leading the U.S. government. So that's an important group, and you want to be able to speak to them and appeal to them. But I don't know to what extent that represents broadly the kind of Washington consensus or the views among the American people. Less expertise, definitely, on that side of things.
You're not a Lindsey Grahamologist. That's okay.
No.
Well, thank you so much, Simon. Really appreciate this and how generous you have been with your time.
Thank you for having me on. Really appreciate the conversation and for dealing with all these hard issues. We need to talk more about them and to keep them in focus and be honest in these conversations. So thank you.
Yeah, and it was nice to see you and Aaron have a civil debate.
Yes.
Thanks, Simon.
Enjoyed it. Thank you, Aaron.
Well, that was a great time, a great debate, many important questions explored, a little scary, you know, when you're talking about World War III and nuclear war, but it was good to hash it out.
Yes. And if you want to read more of Simon Schuster's reporting, he's at Time Magazine, and also his book is called The Showman, Inside the Invasion That Shook the World and Made a Leader of Volodymyr Zelensky.
And he's also on Twitter at Schustry, Schustry. A cute little name, Schustry. Yeah.
All right, that's our show. We're also going to be releasing a bonus interview this weekend featuring comedian Adrian Iacolucci, who has a new special on Netflix called The Dark Queen. So watch out for that on our channels. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next time. Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.
Shop the best Black Friday weekend deals up to 70% off only at Tanger Outlets. Save big at Crocs, Old Navy Outlet, American Eagle Outfitters, Kay Jewelers, and hundreds more. Find something for everyone on your list during our biggest sale of the year. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Stores open at 6 a.m. Black Friday. Get your savings at Tanger.com. Big time deals on big name brands.